Senior Focus.
Kia ora koutou and welcome to Senior Focus. My name is Alex Bonham and I'm standing in for Anne-Marie Currie today. Today we're going to talk about urban planning and particularly how it impacts Auckland. We're going through Plan Change 120 and a pared back version of this goes out for public consultation in August. But replacement legislation to the RMA is going through Select Committee and so a new planning process might well begin in about 18 months' time. With me in the studio, well, he's actually on the phone, but talking to me today is planner Ben Ross, and we hope to provide some insights on what's in store. Ben has worked as a researcher of cities and has over 12 years' experience as a planner, which includes leading submissions to the central government on bills, settling numerous appeals regarding district plans, and designing human-scale urban and transport. He is currently advising the government on a more simplified zoning framework. Welcome, Ben. Thank you for making the time to talk to me.
Kia ora, and thank you, Alex.
So, what sort of environment did you grow up in, Ben?
So, long story short, or as we like to call it out there, the Toolongan revision, I was born and raised in South Auckland. So, I have seen where planning has worked well, and I have seen where planning hasn't quite worked so well out in the streets of the south. I was mentored by my late grandfather in all things geography, which I would take through school, high school, and through to university, qualified out in geography at the University of Auckland, and just fell into planning both here in New Zealand and internationally.
Yeah, so how did that happen, going from geography and political science into transport and then into planning?
I suppose it goes right back to my childhood days where myself and my friends at school, we used to play games like SimCity and then its successor, City Skylines, and I suppose it was just a natural knack for we developed this interest towards urban planning and transport planning that it just morphed into, for me at least, into a career in planning.
Oh, that's so cool. So what does good planning look like?
Good planning basically comes into, is when I dabble into, three forms. The first one is that it should always be bottom-up planning. That is, your community should be the one driving it and leading it. We as planners are there ultimately as facilitators and moderators, and the Resource Management Act, which had been alluded to earlier, is phasing out, has helped with that, but it had gotten bogged down in what we call technical jargon and all that. So that's the first one. The second one is it's all about the human experience. Now, when I did geography, my main focus was with human geography more than physical geography. So we were looking at more at the human experience. That is, and I'm sure my architect and urban design counterparts might have a few words for it, is we're great at building these wonderful physical monoliths in our city, but they are absolutely awful with that human experience. Think things like wheelchair accessibility, think lack of amenities that you might need to, like if you have to quickly duck off to the bathroom with your under 5-year-old who needs to go to the bathroom, or think, have we got water fountains, have we got shade, have we got greenery, which given Auckland's weather today has been absolutely spectacular in the rain department, you'll notice the greenery helps really well with that. And then the third one is, especially with New Zealand Aotearoa, are we working with our indigenous population? Are we working with our Māori? For two it's treated our indigenous population, our indigenous planning as an afterthought rather than as co-authors of their destiny and our destiny. So those are the things they were planning.
So interesting you were saying about that human-centered experience. Like, how do you experience it as a person on the street versus what it might look like in the big model or even from afar? How does this sort of like a... How do you go about that? I appreciate that, you know, engagement is really important to you. So how do you engage a local community in what the area is going to look like?
basically, it's called what's called the IoT 2 model. That's around public participation, and we hopefully, well, for me as a planner specifically, we go down what's the empowerment model. So, for say, with Auckland, the council has set a strategy on where they would like things to go. It is then for the community to basically decide how they want to get there. They're the ones that are going to be living the experience, whether it's positive or negative, and they're going to be the ones so-called selling that experience and that lifestyle to not only to the wider city, but also to the wider world. So when you're engaging them, you want them to become your allies, because your allies become champions and your champions help get some of those more later on controversial projects over the line, and we see plenty about that crop up in the media. So it's just all about basically bring them on board and letting them lead the story. And again, as mentioned earlier, as a planner, I'm there to help facilitate and moderate out, especially when conflicts could arise, as they often do.
Can you give an example of where you've led this process and it's gone well?
So during the pandemic, the pandemic era, it was then known as Panuka Development Auckland. It's now changed over. They had put the call out to do what was known as the innovative street pilots that were tactical urbanism. The idea was is to take a street. In this case, this was in Monaco City Centre, an area very close to my heart as a planner for the last 20 years. And they were wanting to try something that could be done quickly, sold to the public, and then if it was successful, become permanent. So they helped me bring on board not only to help co-design it, but also to help along with the story. And that went really well. When we did the community engagement, there was the normal those for it and those against it. And so you basically listen to them, you basically facilitate the discussion, and in the end, the story, despite some initial concerns, the pilot became a success, and then about a year later, Panuku, now the Auckland Urban Design Office, had informed they'd take it into permanence, and now we've got the product of Osterley Way being a one-way street in part of Monaco, which has now led to now the future works of a brand new cycleway and pedestrian and civic path is being built for that area. So what was an innovative idea has now become an ongoing project for urban renewal, and to which one the community broadly supports.
That's fantastic. I mean, at the moment, we're going through Plan Change 120, which is started off as being a citywide endeavour, and now it looks like it's going to be a smaller version of, with less housing enabled. And there hasn't really been that much in the way of sort of quality engagement. It feels like the goals have kept shifting, and there's never really been enough time to find out what people want. what's your thoughts about the process, and you know, how do we manage it right now?
Well, for PC 120, I do not envy my counterparts in the planning department of Auckland Council. I do not envy the independent hearing panel, the commissioners that will, if they do get to hear, go through the hearings in the end, because, to be brutally honest, they've been hoisted on a project that had came out of PC 120's predecessor, PC 78, which was all about three stories just about everywhere across Auckland. As we know, Cyclone Gabrielle and the Auckland floods caused a major rethink around natural hazards, which brought about PC 120. But I can sympathise with the submitters, both for and against it, that this has been a moving feast, and it's not the fault of council, it's not the fault of the submitters, me being a submitter myself. This is more, and I am going to put it back on Minister Bishop, this is more central government being a little bit rudderless. It's been my firm belief that PC 120 does not need to happen at all, and the minister should just force it and take it off the table. Now, the reason for that is, as you might or might not know, we've got the planning reforms underway. The planning bill is still in select committee at the moment. We've been informed to today that the report was meant to come out to take it into committee or second reading in Parliament this week. It's now been delayed another 4 weeks, which now gives everyone more uncertainty. But Minister Bishop should just basically just go to Mayor Wayne Brown, and we know what the Mayor's going to be like with his very frank and blunt language, but just basically swallow his pride, withdraw PC 120, and then just wait for the planning bill to go live next year, and we can do this properly, because it requires us to go through a full engagement process like we did with the unitary plan, now 10 years ago.
Wow. Okay. I mean, part of the options, or one of the options on the table, is option A, which is pretty much to do the national policy statement of 2020, which always struck me as being a pretty sensible policy to enable more housing close to transport and the centres, even though, you know, how walkable catchments have been applied is up for some debate. I mean, would you sort of recommend going with that sort of option as it being relatively sensible and well socialised, or would you just sort of scrap the whole thing?
In short, I would scrap the whole thing. Again, that's because the new planning bill and what's going to be called the standardised zones will handle all this anyway in a much more robust and in a much more open manner, and where we have a lot more chance for participation. That said, option A, knowing where the reforms are going at the moment and where the zoning is likely to go, is most likely going to be the natural option that's going to fall out of this anyway. What's bolstered or reinforced what is the National Policy Statement Urban Development, which feeds into option A, is we've got two new NPSs or National Policy Statements that assist. One is called Infrastructure, which in short basically requires councils and central government to have the infrastructure enabled, ready to go before urban development can even take place. So you're going into an infrastructure first model.
Yep.
And then the other one is, of course, the famous natural hazards one, which I suppose anyone looking out the window right now in Auckland's probably a good one to consider today, and that avoids putting, it's meant to avoid putting developments into areas that are prone to, for Auckland's case, flooding and landslides, which we know the consequences of that 3 years ago.
So how will those policy statements fit in with these standardised zones? And do you want to talk a little bit about what these standardised zones are and what they look like, how they work?
Certainly, yeah. So I'll touch the standardised zones first, and then we'll jump back to the three national policy statements that will influence them. So as part of the resource management reforms under Minister Bishop, basically, at the moment, we have about 1,100 different zones up and down Aotearoa through all our planning documents. Minister Bishop's intention, and the intention I support, is that we shrink this down to, at the moment, last I looked, about 15 to 17 zones that you can apply no matter which council you are up and down the country. For example, what we call the mixed housing urban zone in Auckland, which allows for three stories as of right, what the objectives, the policies, and the rules are to that zone that applies in Auckland would also apply in Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, Queenstown, or even rural areas like Waikato, Taupo, and so on. And that system was born out of the Japanese and the German planning system. So Minister Bishop is wanting to emulate those two systems to make, so if you're going to do a development in Auckland, it also applies in the South Island. For us as members, as planners, it makes it easier for us to plan and do consenting. For the members of the public and businesses, and also especially businesses as well, if you wish to do engage business in Auckland, you know that the same zone in Auckland is going to apply further down the country. So it's just meant to simplify it and keep it consistent. Given a lot of our growth now crosses boundaries, for example, what happens in Auckland often overflows into the Waikato. What happens in Wellington will overflow into the wider wrapper. So it's just about consistency, ease of reading, and efficiency.
Okay, so I had a bit of a look at the Japanese standardised zones, and there are some opportunities for regional authorities to input into what these zones look like in their area. Things like maybe front yard landscaping or buffers. This is looking at a residential zone, obviously. and how much permeable space there should be. Would that sort of opportunity for local input be on the table for New Zealand as well?
At the local level, no. The way the so-called planning bill sets it out is this would all be tackled much higher level. So when the planning bill goes live, councils are required to do what's called a combined plan, which is your spatial plan, and then your land use plan or district or unitary plans. The things around landscaping, if it makes it into the bill, permeable areas, so how much your plot of land is allowed to have, say concrete, for example. For example, the single house zone in Auckland is, I think the maximum is 60% can be impervious. All that stuff will be decided right up at, unfortunately or unfortunately, depends which way you look at it, up at central government level through the national direction. It's up to the councils basically just to pick and choose from the zones and apply it to their area. So if you haven't submitted on the planning bill, you might be a bit too late, but there might be another opportunity when this new super ministry, that its name I keep forgetting, and I keep just nicknaming the planning ministry, there might be opportunities when that ministry releases the draft into the standardised zones in December. So it's a case of watch this space, listen out to the media, follow your favourite bloggers and social media. You'll hear about it one way or the other, and there could be a good chance to input there later this year.
Yeah, because with the natural hazard issue, the way that council has responded to that is to hold it at its AUP level, whatever zone that was, or to reduce it down to single house zone. And there probably does need to be some zone which is only do something that's not sensitive here because it's at risk. You know, so it could be good for grazing, or a bit of reserve, but you really don't want anyone to build on it or even have commercial activities there, you know? So is that something that is anticipated? How will that be managed?
Yeah, so that would be basically if it's a plot of land that is under the natural hazards, national policy statement, they have a matrix, and if it's deemed under that risk matrix very high, the national policy statement states that development should be prohibited. Basically, nothing should go there because it's of what they call catastrophic risk to life and property. So basically what you would have is something like an open space zone or even a rural zone that would apply to that area. So that would signal to everyone that this area is at very high risk of a natural hazard. You shouldn't develop industry, commercial, residential there. Thus, here it is as a park, or here it is as, say, a rural zone, if it's on, say, Auckland's fringe, to signify that out. And it would be very straightforward when you pull up the maps and it took a look at that specific area.
Okay. What do you do if something is not a risk, you know, catastrophic risk, but is a very likely risk of damaging a property potentially over and over again? Would there be some argument to not build there in the first place?
So if it's not deemed a catastrophic risk, it's jumped down to the very high and high risk categories. My understanding of the way the natural hazards NPS is currently written is that you must take all so-called reasonable means to defend that property, and that any and there is no spillover effects into the neighbouring property. So if you build on an area that could be so-called defended, basically you can't have the floodwaters land in your neighbour's property. That would be spillover effects and technically breaching their enjoyment of their property and their property rights, if we look at the Act Party's overall definition of where they want things to go.
Okay, so if there's, say, a flow path going down between two streets, which is very common in Auckland, part of your property might be at risk of being frequently flooded, but other parts of it, the land is fine, so you might put your house closer to the road, where it might be safer, potentially?
Yeah, you would basically, on how the risk manager would, you would build on the part that could be so-called defended.
Right.
While making sure you don't trigger any spillover effects into either the property next door or even onto public land. It becomes, we'd have to see how the planning bill in itself responds to it more at a more fine level. But for our consent planners that would have to go through the consents, it would be a case-by-case basis on how they approach that.
Okay. Now, something that is really important to Aucklanders and is increasingly important, I think, with heat waves. I mean, we can see the heat waves in Europe at the moment, and it looks like we're going to have more flash floods. We're going to have more periods of drought as well, maybe different years, but more extreme weather. Mm. And trees play a really important role in mitigating flooding and relieving heat through shade and trees' respiration. How do we ensure that we've got enough trees, bearing in mind 9 out of 10 developers chop everything down when they do a project?
Yep, and it's an issue that comes up time and time again. It's presented to the planners time and time again, and our hands are currently tied under the current legislation, and they're going to be further tied under the future legislation. That's because the way the future legislation is currently geared is for the enjoyment of property rights, so that's your own property, but the legislation, the bill lacks looking at things at a wider, wider level. Now, in my own submission to the planning bill, and then when I was presenting to the select committee not long after, I had borrowed a concept that came out of, I believe it was the United States. Someone will probably ping me later on if I get that wrong. And it was called what they called the 330-300 rule. And it's a rough rule that in an urban area, you should, from your window, office window or bedroom window or lounge window, you should be able to see 3 trees of your urban area. 30% of it should be under tree canopy, and you should be no more than 300 metres from your nearest green park of any size. So that's either a pocket park right up to your big regional parks.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is this. It's quite multifaceted, multifold. At the moment, it's absolutely pouring with rain in Auckland, and Auckland is very prone to stormwater flooding. By following that rule, 330-300 rule, it's the trees and the greenery slow that flooding and slow that stormwater intake down into our often overloaded and often beleaguered systems. For those keeping up with the news, you'll see the huge heat waves in Europe, where it's about 40 degrees in France at the moment. Trees cool the urban area down by up to, on a good day, up to 7 degrees. So if it's 40 degrees out on the open road, it should be in the low 30s, if not high 20s, in the shade.
Yeah.
And there's also the mental, what I call the mental health side. Just looking at trees, listening to our native birds, listening to our tui and our kiraru, and those noisy little piwaka walkers making a racket for themselves has that calming effect. And when we're not, when we're calm, we're more productive. So, yeah. So basically, my submission said that rule's got to be enshrined into the planning system. No, it doesn't affect developers, but it makes developers, and it even makes us as stewards of our own property a little bit more responsive and think a little bit harder on how we can do this a little bit better, especially as we are getting warmer, we are getting wetter, and we're going to need those green sanctuaries even more and more.
Yeah, I think that's true. When you look at some of the older suburbs, they have very narrow streets. There's no room to put trees onto the footpaths. So the front yard landscaping rules are... Yeah. Very important to ensure there's some trees, but also that green habitat for the birds and the insects and everything. That worries me a bit, because I know how important it is to people in Auckland is to have that green space. And you'll be aware that a couple of years ago, Sir Peter Glutman published his report on the future of Auckland with a number of different ideas as conversation points. And the one that particularly went down well was that the whole of Auckland become a regional park and have bird corridors, have trees, and then have these wonderful parks and regional parks as major nodes. But but greenery everywhere. And that sort of aligns with the water sensitive city and the green cities approach, which I think is much desired. You know, I think we could be having a conversation about going up a bit more, whether it's even 15 meter height in a mixed housing urban or 11 meters in a single house zone. But the offset of that is a little bit more space for landscaping, or not a lot more space. It's no more than we have now, but just not reducing it as much as seems to be the risk with the future planning rules.
Yes. If you look to the United States, especially the older cities, Chicago and New York come to mind the quickest. You look at their famous row houses that you often see on programs that come out of the States. Now, those are right up against the road, yet they still manage to blend in those trees, blend in that landscaping, so it just all looks natural. This is something we haven't quite grasped as well yet. That said, those American cities also play a huge big part on communal lots as well. So you've got those parks spread out and intermixed quite frequently. So that comes down to that 300 meter rule that I mentioned earlier. You're no more than 300 meters from your nearest park. Now, when I mention park, people are probably thinking those big 5,000 square meter, half a hectare sodders with the big playgrounds and that, and they'll be balking at the cost of it. Perfectly understandable. I'm not talking about that. Those are nice to have, and you have a few that. I'm talking about your little pocket parks that are no bigger than, say, 400 square metres, which is the current average lot size in Auckland at the moment, dotted at regular intervals along your streets of your medium density, and you'll find those would be quite heavily used in the summer, if not winter as well. So we just have to be a bit smarter in how we do this.
And we have to
not be afraid of looking abroad to different solutions as well.
What other incentives? Because, I mean, it's quite expensive to buy even a single site in an old suburb, I'd say. And there's an argument that private developers should, you know, deliver this green space where there once was some. And I wondered if there are other levers that we could do to encourage things like perimeter blocks or holding on to green space, even if you are allowed to get rid of it. And if so, what would they be?
So the first thing is council needs to stop selling off its land, for starters.
Yeah.
I've never, personally, and it's well known amongst my counterparts, even with sitting councils, that I've never agreed with the 2015 Len Brown land sale policy. Council should be hanging on to its land, because those are the spaces where you can get your greenery. If you're not doing urban development, those are also your spaces where you can convert them over into parks. Because it's already council-owned, it's a zero cost. So you're basically just paying for the trees and the initial maintenance. So council selling off its land means it's going to be more expensive when we do development to get those spaces back for parks later on. So that's one thing. I've just been doing some research and having developers be bonded and providing green space, and they have to maintain it for so many years before it's vested back into council, which is commonly done in the US. And then the other one is basically we've got to make sure when we do our spatial plan for next year that we just are mapping this out properly, because at the moment our mapping's still not quite there. And as Auckland continues to develop, we have to know where we want our green infrastructure to go to make sure that our city is still and becomes a better green city than it is now.
Ben, thank you so much for your time today. We're running out of time. I could talk to you for much, much longer. But just a reminder to listeners that Plan Change 120 does go out for consultation in August. So look out for that and make the recommendations you wish to make. And we will keep our eyes peeled in December for more information about those proposed changes to legislation. Ben, thank you very, very much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. The pleasure's been all mine.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.
London's burning! London's burning!